Is everybody ready?
1 second.
Pete, I'm here.
Oh, great. Thank you, Keith. Okay.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are recording and broadcasting. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Good morning, members of the board, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the regular meeting of the Lahontan Regional Water Quality Control Board. My name is Pete Pumphrey. I'm from Chalfont, California, and I am the board chair. I want to thank you for listening to our meeting. We welcome your comments, ideas, and participation because they help us to do a better job. Today's board meeting is being conducted during the COVID-19 emergency and is therefore a virtual board meeting. In order to comply with public gathering and physical distancing requirements and the governor's executive orders, there is no physical meeting room. Bob Lloyd with AGP Video is hosting our virtual board meeting for us. I will ask him now to give us some instructions to help us run this meeting smoothly. Bob?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Bob Lloyd with AGP Video. We'd like to make sure that people speak slowly and clearly. There is a court reporter recording this. We'd also like to have you mute microphones when not in use. And promotions for or attendees or public will be allowed to speak during the items. Use the raise hand feature to get our attention to speak. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate your patience and understanding during this difficult time. Hopefully this might be the last time that the board at least has to meet over this platform, but we're not sure. We have our fingers crossed that we'll get to see each other for the first time in a couple of years. At this time, I would like to introduce the other members of the regional board attending via video and teleconferencing. Keith Dias from Rosamond.
Good morning.
Dr. Amy Horn from Truckee.
Hi there.
Esra Mostafavi from Bishop.
Good morning.
Kimberly Cox, our board member from Hellendale, is unable to join us today. Our executive board staff are here today, including our executive officer, Mike Plasiak, our assistant executive officer, Ben Letton, our legal counsel, Elizabeth Barrett, and our board clerk, Katrina Fleshman. We will also be joined by other staff members for individual agenda presentations. For people who only want to listen and or watch the meeting, the board's customary webcast is available. In addition, we are receiving presentations and public comment through a Zoom meeting platform. If you intend to present or comment, you should have submitted a virtual speaker card to our board clerk, Katrina Fleshman, and be in the Zoom meeting room. This meeting is being webcasted and recorded, so please speak clearly. If you think you might be interested in commenting or are experiencing any technical difficulties, please contact our board clerk promptly at katrina.fleshman@waterboards.ca.gov. For those in the Zoom meeting, your camera will be turned off and you will be on mute until it is your turn to speak. Our board clerk will unmute you when it is your turn. When you are done speaking and the board members have completed asking questions, you will be placed on mute again. With that, we will go to our first item today, which is item 7 in our agenda, which is public forum. Any person may address the water board regarding a matter within the water board's jurisdiction that is not related to an item on this meeting agenda or currently pending before the water board. I do not have any speaker cards for public comment this morning. Is there anyone in the Zoom universe who wishes to address the board? It appears that there is not. Therefore, we will go to item 8. On the agenda, which is a workshop regarding the draft basin plan amendment for fecal bacteria water quality objectives.
Hi, good morning. I'll just wait for the presentation to be put on the screen. Excellent. Okay, good morning, Chairman Pumphrey and board members. I am presenting an information item regarding the draft proposed basin plan amendments for fecal bacteria objectives in the Lahontan region. The draft amendments are presently in a public comment period, which is set to close in mid-April. So to be clear, no board action is requested related to this topic today, and this presentation is made for information purposes. My name is Ed Hancock. I'm an environmental scientist working in the planning and assessment unit. The proposed draft amendments you will hear about today are a result of the fecal bacteria objectives evaluation project that I presented to the board in January and May of 2021. So next slide, please. So here's a roadmap for today's presentation. I'm going to spend a few minutes on project background to refresh our collective memories about the path that led us to propose these basin plan amendments. I will provide a summary of the proposed amendments themselves. I'll spend some time on how the public have been involved in the process so far and the upcoming opportunities for the public to engage with the amendment process. And I'll finish up with details about the proposed schedule for the remainder of the amendment process. So next slide, please. So as I think many of us are aware, the Lahontan Basin Plan contains fecal coliform bacteria water quality objectives for feces-related water quality issues in the region's surface waters and wetlands. These objectives are not specifically tied to a beneficial use in the basin plan, and they are generally applicable to all surface waters and wetlands in the region. Those objectives are contained in Basin Plan Chapter 3, which is the water quality objectives chapter, and in Chapter 5, which contains objectives specific to the Lake Tahoe Basin. So instead of fecal coliforms, US EPA recommends the fecal indicator bacteria Escherichia coli, better known as E. coli, or Enterococci bacteria to determine if surface waters contain fecal material manifesting a public health risk. US EPA made these recommendations first in 1986 with the circulation of their ambient water quality criteria for bacteria, and then again in 2012 with the recreational water quality criteria. The 1986 and 2012 criteria are very similar, and both documents propose the same water quality standards. The most notable difference between the 86 and 2012 documents relates to the definition of gastrointestinal illness. The 2012 criteria uses a more expansive definition, which better reflects the types of symptoms which may present with this type of illness. Next slide, please. So in August of 2018, the State Water Board adopted part three of the Inland Surface Waters Enclosed Bays and Estuaries Plan, which is known by the shorthand bacteria provisions. The bacteria provisions contain a set of fecal bacteria water quality objectives designed to protect the water contact recreation, also known as REC 1, beneficial use. And these criteria are based on those US EPA 2012 recreational water quality criteria. The objectives of the bacteria provisions apply to all surface waters in the state of California where REC 1 uses occur, including in the Lahontan region. The new objectives specifically do not supersede the existing Lahontan region fecal coliform objectives, meaning that presently both the basin plan objectives and the statewide bacteria provisions objectives apply to the vast majority of Lahontan region surface waters and wetlands. Next slide, please. So in the resolution that adopted the bacteria provisions, the State Water Board encouraged the Lahontan Board to evaluate the basin plan fecal coliform objectives. And that is exactly what we did. The board prioritized the evaluation project as the number one priority of the 2018 triennial review. Staff began evaluation of the objectives in 2019, completing that evaluation process in 2021 with a recommendation to remove the fecal coliform objectives from the basin plan. Details of the evaluation project can be found in the January 2021 evaluation project staff report, the contents of which were discussed at the January 21 Water Board meeting. At the conclusion of that meeting, the board asked staff to return to them with some more information about a possible basin plan amendment. And this information was presented and discussed at the May 2021 board meeting. All information and documents related to related to those two meetings is on the board's website and can be accessed via the Basin Plan Program webpage. So next slide, please. So at the May 21 board meeting, there was a lengthy discussion about this project, including regarding possible elements for a basin plan amendment, such as the preservation of the numeric threshold associated with the fecal coliform objective, a discussion of beneficial uses and how these uses manifest in the region, and a discussion about the state of the science surrounding fecal indicator bacteria. The board heard from stakeholders in the region who offered a variety of regional perspectives about fecal bacteria objectives. And the outcome of this meeting was a direction to begin developing a basin plan amendment to remove fecal coliform, really based on the state of the science surrounding this indicator bacteria. So staff have now developed the draft proposed amendment, including tribal and stakeholder engagement in accordance with state law, and prepared the documents required to support a change to the basin plan. The draft project documents, including the draft proposed amendments, are presently in the public sphere for review and to solicit public comment, with the comment period closing later this April. Next slide, please. So I'll now give a summary of the proposed amendments, but before I do, I will remind us that this presentation today is given for information purposes and no board action is requested at this time. Again, those proposed amendments are in the middle of a public comment period. So on to the summary. The fecal coliform indicator and its associated water quality objectives are removed from both Chapter 3 and Chapter 5 of the Basin Plan. Fecal coliforms are problematic indicator bacteria because they are known to originate from one or more non-fecal sources. In place of the fecal coliform objectives, a summary of the statewide bacteria provisions objectives is added to both Basin Plan Chapter 3 and Chapter 5, with additional language that directs the Basin Plan user to the bacteria provisions documentation for a full accounting of the objectives and associated implementation plan. As I mentioned earlier, the bacteria provisions are based on US EPA's 2012 recreational water quality criteria, which recommend E. coli and Enterococci as indicators of the presence of fecal pathogens harmful to the public health. Next slide, please. In addition to the changes described on the previous slide, the fecal bacteria narrative objectives of both chapters 3 and chapter 5 is changed from waters shall not contain concentrations of coliform organisms attributable to anthropogenic sources to waters shall not contain concentrations of fecal material deleterious to beneficial uses. This change recognizes that the state of the science surrounding coliform organisms has developed since the last time the Basin Plan was revised for this type of pollutant. The addition of the language fecal material is made to allow for the variety of modern approaches to determine the presence of fecal wastes in surface waters, and the phrase deleterious to beneficial uses is included so that the narrative objective is applicable in a variety of possible water quality situations. That narrative objective remains applicable to all beneficial uses of the region. The proposed changes to the narrative help the board to address many different types of feces-related water quality issues, including those situations where beneficial uses may be impacted by fecal material which does not rise to the level that exceeds the water contact recreation objectives of the bacteria provisions. Together, the addition of fecal material deleterious to beneficial uses provides scope for the board to apply new feces-related water quality evaluation guidelines, thresholds, and monitoring techniques should they be appropriate to protect beneficial uses in the future. In addition to those changes, other editorial changes are made to remove references to fecal coliforms. These changes occur again in chapters 3 and 5 in reference to fecal coliform log means and to chapter 4.9, where there is a discussion of range management and fecal coliforms. A full explanation of all the proposed changes associated with the amendments are included in section 5 of the staff report, which is in enclosure 1 for item 8. Bate stamp 8-16 of your board packet. So next slide, please. There are no foreseeable environmental effects or changes to water quality from the proposed basin plan amendments. The proposed amendments do not constitute a physical change to the environment. A full analysis of this topic is included in the supporting staff report and substitute environmental document. US EPA does not recommend fecal coliforms as an indicator of fecal pollution in surface waters because some members of this group of bacteria are known to originate from one or more non-fecal sources, including from industrial processes such as paper milling. Additionally, the numeric thresholds associated with the fecal coliform objective were developed via a less mathematically robust approach to risk assessment when compared to the numeric thresholds of the 2012 recreational water quality criteria. I'm happy to provide more details on the development of the fecal coliform threshold if that is useful, but in the interest of our time today, the important fact here is that multi-study epidemiological work carried out in the 1980s and in the 2000s by US EPA has found the presence of E. coli and enterococci in surface waters to be better predictors of gastrointestinal illnesses in water contact recreators, and this has led to the development of national water quality criteria, which, when achieved, ensure full support for water contact recreation beneficial uses. Those national water quality criteria are the basis, my computer just did something very funny. Okay, so those national water quality criteria are the basis for the bacteria provisions objectives, which are already effective for Lahontan region surface waters. This amendment does not change those objectives, but it does add text pertaining to them to the Lahontan region basin plan. In addition, the proposed amendments ensure that the narrative objective continues to be applicable to all regional surface waters, wetlands, and beneficial uses. The proposed changes to this objective are made to better align the basin plan with the state of the science, by removing the requirement that coliform organisms be used to detect water quality problems. The proposed narrative statement constitutes an expansive and flexible approach which the Water Board may use to address fecal pollution affecting beneficial uses in a variety of settings, including the derivation of limitations, targets, thresholds, or other requirements to protect water quality. The proposed narrative constitutes a protective backstop for all uses of water in the region and provides a tool that the board may use to ensure that the Lahontan region surface water quality is maintained into the future. Next slide, please. So as many of us may know, the State Water Board and US EPA have adopted anti-degradation policies intended to protect existing high quality waters. This proposed basin plan amendment is consistent with both of those policies. The proposed amendment does not authorize the degradation of water quality, nor are adverse changes to water quality expected as a result of the project. Based on the analysis prepared for the entire project, there is no evidence to suggest that the amendment would cause degradation of any Lahontan region surface waters. The proposed draft amendments will continue to maintain and protect waters via a combination of the latest science regarding fecal indicator bacteria, risk-based thresholds associated with those indicators designed to ensure water contact recreators are protected from illness, and a narrative objective protective of all beneficial uses. Next slide, please. So there are two outstanding national resource waters, also known as ONRWs, in the Lahontan region. And actually, the region is home to the only two ONRWs in the state of California. I'm sure we are all aware those waters are Lake Tahoe and Mono Lake. ONRWs are recognized for their ecological and societal value they provide and are provided the highest levels of water quality protections via state and federal anti-degradation policies. So this proposed amendment will not change water quality in Lake Tahoe or Mono Lake. As I mentioned on a previous slide, this amendment is designed to maintain surface water quality and protect beneficial uses via a combination of the latest science regarding indicator bacteria, risk-based thresholds associated with those indicators, and a narrative objective which is applicable to a range of fecal bacteria water quality issues. Tahoe and Mono Lake remain subject to a variety of region-wide and watershed-specific basin plan prohibitions, and the board administers oversight of all proposed discharges to these surface waters. So I'd like to make a note here that while we have spent a lot of time talking about E. coli for this project, the bacteria provisions do contain water quality objectives for fresh surface waters and saline surface waters, and each category uses a different indicator bacteria and associated objective. The E. coli indicator applies to fresh waters, such as Lake Tahoe, and the enterococci indicator applies to saline surface waters, such as Mono Lake. The bacteria provisions include information to determine a fresh versus saline water, and hence which bacteria indicator and objective to apply. Next slide, please. So the draft basin plan amendments, supporting staff report, and substitute environmental documents were released for a 45-day public review on February 23rd of this year. The comment period remains open, and interested parties are encouraged to submit written comments prior to the comment deadline of April 15th. After that comment period closes, staff will engage in comment and document review, and that is scheduled for this spring and summer. Responses to comments and any subsequent changes to the project documents will be released to the public ahead of a board hearing for the amendment this coming November. Next slide, please. So it's the state of California policy that every state agency encourages consultation and communication with California Native American tribes so that tribes may provide meaningful input in the development of regulations, rules, and policies. Consulting with tribes may assist agencies in determining how a project may impact a tribal cultural resource, and if so, how such effects may be avoided or mitigated. So on August 4th of 2021, staff notified California Native American tribes of the opportunity to consult with the board on this basin plan amendment. Staff received three responses: the Shingle Springs Band of Miwok Indians, the San Manuel Band of Mission Indians, and the United Auburn Indian Community. None of those responses requested a consultation with staff, instead indicating the preference to not consult. And we have received no additional requests for consultation on this amendment project from California tribes. Next slide, please. So when developing this basin plan amendment, staff sought to engage interested parties to help determine topics for environmental analyses that should be included in the substitute environmental document. This type of engagement is known as scoping. Essentially, we ask the public to help us define the scope of analysis for a given project. Scoping consists of a period during which the public can submit written comments to staff, and also includes a public meeting convened by staff where the public can provide verbal comments and ask process-related questions about the project. So staff circulated notices about the scoping period on August 23rd, 2021, with a deadline to provide written comments closing on October 29th. So there was a disruption during the comment period because of the Caldor fire, which closed the board's South Lake Tahoe office and forced the evacuation of many regional stakeholders and staff. Because of this disruption, staff rescheduled the scoping meeting and extended that comment deadline through to the end of October. The rescheduled scoping meeting was held on October 14th, and staff were joined by 11 interested parties, several of whom asked non-technical questions about the project process. One substantive comment was received via email during that meeting and was read into the record by project staff. One more written comment was received prior to the October 29th comment deadline, and all those comments were considered during the development of the proposed amendment. Next slide, please. So here's a timeline for the proposed amendment process. Final project documents will be released to the public ahead of a board hearing in November of this year. With the assumption that the board adopts the amendments in November, the next step is to present the amendments to the State Water Board, which is tentatively scheduled to occur early in 2023. Once approved at the state board level, the amendments will be considered by the Office of Administrative Law and by US EPA, and that is also tentatively scheduled to occur in 2023. Next slide, please. And that brings me to the end of the material that I have prepared today. My contact information and the webpage location of the draft proposed amendment text, draft staff report, and substitute environmental document is included on this slide. I'm available to answer questions about the project either now or at a later time after the conclusion of this meeting. I will remind all those preparing to give verbal comments today that any verbal comments given before the board will become part of the project record. I strongly encourage those interested in providing comments on this project to do so in written format. Interested parties may also contact me to obtain paper copies of the project documents. And with that, Chairman Pumphrey, I'll pass the mic to you. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. Before I turn to board members, let me just, I have no speaker requests for this item. And let me just ask if there is anyone who is participating in this meeting who wishes to make a comment at this time regarding this agenda item.
Chair Pumphrey, this is Ben Lutton, Assistant Executive Officer. I believe there may be someone who would like to speak, Mr. Tom Talbot. Mr. Talbot, if you are interested in speaking to this item, you're please do so. Your mic is unmuted.
Okay. So, thank you. You know, I don't think there's anything at this point that I want to expound on. Ed, it was a great presentation there. I strongly support everything you're saying, and I will look forward to putting my comments in a written form. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, sir.
We do not have any other speaker cards or aware of any other member of the public who would like to speak at this time.
Thank you. So I'll turn now to board members for both comments and questions regarding this presentation for Mr. Hancock, beginning with Mr. Dias.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ed, it was a very good presentation. It was very clear and comprehensive. I do have a question regarding public comments. I think you said there was one substantive comment and several others. Were there in the comments, were there any objections to removing the reference to fecal coliform in the basin plan?
Yes, that we received one comment via email, which did encourage us not to remove fecal coliform, the fecal coliform threshold, I should say, from the basin plan. That was received during the scoping meeting, and we read that into the record. There was another comment received as well, which supported removing fecal coliform and the objective from the basin plan.
Okay, thank you. No more questions.
Dr. Horn?
Thank you, Chair Pumphrey. Yes, I agree with Mr. Dias, Ed. That was a very clear presentation and very comprehensive. And following up on Mr. Dias's question, I was just wondering if the commenter who opposed removing the fecal coliform water quality objective gave a reason for opposing that.
Their position is that removing the fecal coliform objective would hamper the board's ability to regulate discharges of this type of pollutant.
Okay.
So their argument is that the fecal coliform objective is a highly protective number, and that would cause issues for the board in the future should they need to take action.
Okay.
Could I also add a clarifying point? that those comments that were submitted were part of the CEQA scoping period. And so that particular commenter did not see the language that is currently in draft form when they wrote that comment. And so the nature of the comments may change after reading the language that Ed put forward. Thank you.
Thank you for that clarification. One of our goals as a water quality agency is to provide good customer service. And in general, I think it's a good idea. Part of that is removing outdated science from our basin plan. So I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
Board Member Mustafavi.
I have no comments. Thank you.
Thank you. The advantage of being last is that the question that I was going to ask has been asked, and the comments I was going to make have been made, except to say that your presentations are always so full of information and cleanly organized that they're very much a pleasure and very helpful. Appreciate it. It looks like we're proceeding apace. I look forward to seeing the final proposed amendment in November. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Board Chair.
Now turn to item 9 on the agenda, which is the triennial review hearing and board consideration.
Okay, I'm up. Good morning, Chair Pumphrey, members of the board, and any members of the public that are joining us here this morning. My name is Daniel Sussman, and I'm a senior environmental scientist in your Tahoe office. I supervise the planning and assessment unit, which includes the basin planning program. And this morning, I'll be discussing the 2022 triennial review of the water quality control plan for the Lahontan Basin, or the basin plan, as we commonly refer to it. Next slide, please. So here's a quick overview of this item. I'm going to revisit the reason we're here and then give a recap of the public process for the triennial review. I'll discuss the way in which we ranked the basin planning issues and display the results of that prioritization process. Then we'll discuss the comment letters sent to us during circulation of the draft triennial review. And this is an action item, so I'll end with the staff recommendation to the board. Next slide, please. As a reminder, we're here today because of a requirement in both the Clean Water Act and the Porter Cologne Act, which requires the Water Board to periodically review water quality standards. The two laws have slightly different language, and the triennial review satisfies both. In doing so, we are able to identify and describe issues that may require a basin plan amendment and provide an estimate of the resources required to evaluate and address the issue. The process includes assigning a general ranking of these issues, and those previous three bullets are all addressed by the triennial review list, which is attachment A in your packet, starting on base stamp page 9-9. The regulations also require identification of which items will be addressed and which require additional resources. In our case, the items that will be addressed in whole or partially over the next 3 years, effectively the three-year work plan for the basin planning program, are those identified as high priority in attachment A. The rest of the issues require additional resources, and the process must also be a public one. Next slide, please. So the 2022 triennial review public process began in late August of last year with the notice of public workshop and solicitation of triennial review topics. The workshop was originally scheduled for September, but the Calder Fire, of course, said no to that. Instead, I spoke to you on October 6th. At that meeting, we discussed an unranked list of potential basin planning issues, prioritization approaches, we heard input from various members of the public, and the board gave direction to staff. In mid-December, we released a draft staff report and a draft list of ranked basin planning issues for public review. The board item materials became public more recently, and the final staff report begins on Bates stamp page 9-18. And here we are on March 18th, on March 10th for a hearing. Next slide. So I think it's useful to revisit the last time the board heard from me on this topic on October 6th, 2021. The board gave guidance to staff about the prioritization and that the regional goals should guide the process. Another comment was to reduce the total number of issues in the triennial review list. And we've done that by combining topics and also, frankly, by incorporating some of the non-regulatory edits that were in that first list into a forthcoming amendment that incidentally should be flown for a public comment period as soon as tomorrow. There were multiple speakers at the October 6th board workshop, and their comments centered on these three topics: the designation of tribal beneficial uses, Laurel Pond and its beneficial use designations, and the bacteria effort that Ed discussed in the previous agenda item. Next slide, please. So the Lahontan Board regional goals are shown in the box on the right in this slide, numbered 1 through 4. They are to protect human health and aquatic life, protect and improve aquatic resources and water quality, promote a safe work environment, and provide exceptional customer service while being realistic about resources and commitments. The regional goals are the touchstone for everything we do at the Lahontan Water Board. They reflect the way in which we pursue our mission and are what we use to help make hard decisions among competing priorities and resource limitations. And this is not just in the basin planning world. So it makes sense to prioritize the triennial review list using criteria that stem from or are derived from the regional goals. Staff prioritized the 18 triennial review basin planning issues using these 9 criteria. The numbers in parentheses show which regional goal a single criteria corresponds to. They are to protect human health, protect aquatic life, pertaining to California's 2 ONRWs, related to climate change, adaptation and mitigation, to seek environmental justice and the intentional support of disadvantaged communities, improving communication by promoting clarity and consistency, customer service responsiveness by improving process efficiency, and seeking agreeable water quality improvements. The last two criteria are not so closely linked with the regional goals, but are important considerations when making the right prioritization decisions. They are previous priority with allocated resources, and that the basin planning issue really fits in this triennial review period. And there's a more detailed description of these criteria available starting on base stamp page 9-24. Now, before the big reveal, I want to note that the staff's prioritization assessment treated these criteria equally, with the exception of protection of human health, which had an influence 1.5 times any other individual criteria. Next slide. So these are the topics that make up the high priority category. These are the ones that we are committed to working on in the next few years. Like all the categories, high, medium, and low, these are not ranked within this group. This category includes bacteria water quality objectives, an editorial amendment to clean up some errors and outdated information in the basin plan, an investigation into using prohibitions to protect critical groundwater recharge in the face of climate change, investigating creation and designation of a high quality beneficial use, which grew out of our discussions at last May's board meeting, and evaluating opportunities to improve clarity and consistency and efficiency, regulating discharges in riparian and floodplain areas, then designating tribal and subsistence beneficial uses, and evaluating an update to the nitrogen objective for Hot Creek in Mono County. Now, the asterisks on the screen denote topics that staff are already engaged in. Now, I'll be happy to do my best to answer any questions you have about these items or the others in the triennial review list after the presentation. I also want to highlight that our basin planning staff are limited, and many of these basin planning issues will rely on collaboration with our colleagues in both Victorville and in the Tahoe offices. Next slide. Now, don't worry, I won't read these next two slides as I did the last one. You all can read just as well as I. I just want to make sure the board and the wider audience has a chance to review the issues we ranked as medium priority. And next slide, please. And those ranked as low priority for this triennial review period. I do want to highlight that everything you see on this slide and the previous is a worthy issue to address. However, when assessing them against our regional goals-based criteria, the readiness or urgency of the issue and other resource limitations, they did not rise to high priority and will have to wait for another day for their time in the sun. Next slide. So we received two comment letters on the draft triennial review staff report and list. The first was submitted by Garrett Higgard, district engineer of the Mammoth Community Water District, requesting the evaluation of Laurel Pond beneficial uses be elevated to high priority. The second letter was submitted by Hazem Gaber, senior manager of Wetlands and Waterways for Southern California Edison. SCE operates a number of hydroelectric dams on the east side, and the letter focused on concerns related to regulation of SCE operations and maintenance activities. Staff considered these letters in preparation of the proposed triennial review list and prepared responses to these comment letters. The response to comments document begins on Bates stamp page 9-28 of your packet. Next slide. So today, staff recommends the board adopt the resolution and attachment A as proposed. The resolution begins on Bates stamp 9-6, followed by attachment A, the prioritized triennial review list. Now, after board adoption, staff will send that package to US EPA to complete the process, and we will get back to work. Thank you. And back to you, Chair Pumphrey.
Thank you. I believe that we do have speaker requests on this item. So before we get to those, let me just ask if there are any questions regarding the presentation from any board member. Does not appear that there are. So I believe there are some speaker requests. If there is anyone who wishes to speak to this matter, this is your opportunity to do so at this time. Please indicate by using the raise hand figure and we will enable you to speak to us.
Yes, we have Heidi Keller from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. Ms. Calvert, you're unmuted and go ahead and speak whenever you're ready.
Thanks. Good morning, Chairman and board members. My name is Heidi Calvert. I'm an environmental program manager with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife in our Region 6. I oversee regional hatcheries, including Hot Creek Hatchery in Mono County. I've worked with your staff on various items, including our new NPDES permit for the facility. So thank you, Dan, for a very informative presentation on the recommendations and the process. CDFW strongly supports staff recommendations that the total nitrogen water quality objective update in the 2022 triennial review of the basin plan be a high priority. Hot Creek Hatchery has a recently adopted May 2021 NPDES permit and associated TSO to allow the facility to operate in compliance with the basin plan. Our previous permit and TSO expired, and then the absence of a new permit resulted in penalties to CDFW for noncompliance. We appreciate the board's support to work on the total nitrogen water quality objective, which will hopefully result in a long-term solution and eliminate the need for continued TSOs. So as Dan mentioned, we've conducted an introductory meeting with your staff on this issue. And CDFW can absolutely commit staff resources to assist your staff in the review process. We have fisheries and water quality expertise, as well as a lot of historical data for the area. And so we look forward to working with your staff on this issue. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Calvert. Let me see if there are any questions from any board member for you. Does not appear that there are. Thank you again for taking the time to participate with us and for your comments.
Thank you.
If there are no other public comments, I turn to board members for comment and or a possible action. Mr. Dias?
Board Chair, excuse me. Humphrey. Sorry for the interruption. Ben, go ahead.
Chair Pumphrey, I do have Tess Dunham in our attendee list, and although her hand is not raised, I'd like to ask her if she has any comments on this item.
Okay.
She's not responding to the request to speak, so.
It looks like she's still muted.
Yeah. Tess, if you're out there and want to unmute your mic and speak to this item, please do so. Okay, hearing no response, I think we're safe to move on, Mr. Pumphrey.
Thank you. So I'll circle around again to Mr. Dias.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Great job, Dan. As usual, a very, very good presentation. I'm very pleased with the review list that we've developed, and I'm especially appreciative of the groundwater protection prohibitions we've included. No more comments. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Horn?
Yeah, this triennial review item has always been vexing to me throughout the years. It's a very difficult one because our basin plan is our guiding document and it's really, really important. The process of changing the basin plan is very slow and we have very few resources to assign to keeping the basin plan in good shape. So for a long time, the triennial review has felt like a bit of an albatross hanging around our necks that just never went away. And it was hard to see progress in addressing the issues on the triennial review list. The adoption of the regional goals and priorities has really helped this process significantly, I think. And I like the prioritization process. The list of high priority projects resulting from it makes sense to me. And I was delighted that such a elegantly simple prioritization process resulted in such a great list. Going forward, I hope we can continue to improve the process, the basin planning processes even more. For example, another region only puts on its triennial review list those things that it can accomplish within a three-year cycle. And the advantage of that, I think, is that at the end of the 3 years, you can go check, 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 and really feel like you're making progress on improving the basin plan. Doesn't have to be an entire project if the whole project can't be accomplished within 3 years. But if some steps could be identified towards getting that project done, I think helpful. Longer term, I think it might be helpful, and this may sound contradictory, but it really isn't, to set audacious goals for basin planning, such as getting all of the current needs addressed within two or three planning cycles. I'm just throwing that out there. Don't be scared. An audacious goal is something like what Bill Gates and Paul Allen set in the 1970s, which was for a computer to be on every desk in every household in the country. And which seemed, you know, back in those days, I believe we were still using punch cards with mainframe computers, and see how their audacious goal has changed all our lives. Audacious long-term planning often is used in the business community because it can lead to innovation and creativity and finding new ways to get things, to get work done. And in this way, we, with these kinds of changes in how we do the triennial review process, I think we can transform it from an immovable object that weighs us down to something that we feel good about and can see that we're making progress on. And with that, I'm willing to propose that we adopt the resolution and attachment A as proposed.
Thank you. Board Member Mostafavi.
I have no questions. Thank you.
Any comments?
No comments.
Thank you. I have a couple comments. Dr. Horn, I think, really hit the nail precisely on the head. And I commend the staff for this approach. This has been one of the agenda items I least looked forward to in the time that I've been on the board, and that all changed today. And it changed, I think, as a result of the way that we approach this, and as outlined by Dr. Horn. I think all of the things that we are doing seem to me to be a lot more comprehensive in nature, and based a lot more clearly on a sense of prioritization that go along with what we think our objectives are as an organization. So I salute the staff for that. I think it is possible to meld this triennial review process into the larger question of what is the board about and where is it going? And I think we've taken a big step towards doing that. In the past, the triennial review has always seemed to me to be something that was sort of set off in its own little corner and not well coordinated or related to the other things that we did. And that feeling isn't here at this point. And so I'm very pleased with that. So thank you for your very good work. And would anyone like to second Dr. Horn's motion?
This is Keith. I will second the motion.
It has been moved and seconded. Mr. Dias.
Aye.
Dr. Horn.
Aye.
Ms. Mostafavi.
Aye.
And I vote aye as well. Thank you, Mr. Sussman, for a very excellent presentation and a very excellent piece of work.
Thank you all.
Our last item on the agenda this morning is an update and review of the situation at the Leviathan mine.
Good morning, board members. This is Scott Ferguson. I'll be presenting today on this agenda item, and I'm supervising water resource control engineer on your staff. Also the division manager of the Water Board's Cleanup and Enforcement Division, which includes our Leviathan Mine Unit. Today's presentation, or agenda item number 10, is an informational item, and today's presentation is going to focus largely on the early final remedial action that has been proposed by Atlantic Richfield, and the draft focus feasibility study and draft technical and practicability evaluation Atlantic Richfield has drafted and submitted for agency and stakeholder review and comment at US EPA's direction. And before I get going on the presentation, I'd like to first acknowledge the work that the Leviathan team has put into the review of and comments on the focus feasibility study and technical and practicability evaluation. And that forms the basis for this morning's presentation and the company's staff report. They have also provided significant input on the Leviathan Mine presentation. And my thanks go out to Kathy Poole, Chris Stetler, Anna Bartholomew, Taylor Zettner, Darren Witt, Mark Minsky, and our legal team, David Koop with the Office of Chief Counsel, and Tom Bloomfield and Sarah Mogorabi of Kaplan, Kirsch, and Rockwell, which is our outside legal counsel. And my apologies to Sarah for stumbling on her last name. Next slide, please. Primary purpose of today's presentation is to share with you information regarding the Leviathan Mine Superfund site's progress through the CERCLA process, focusing largely on the early final remedial action proposed by Atlantic Richfield in early 2019, and that has subsequently evolved. Today's agenda item will also be an opportunity to identify the benefits of the early final remedial action, or what I'll refer to going forward as the EFRA for short. Water Board staff believes that some elements of the EFRA are primed and ready to move forward, while other elements still need some work before they can move forward or be incorporated. These elements requiring work represent some of the challenges and complexities that staff and the stakeholders and the agencies have been and will continue to work on. And we'll also have an opportunity for board members to ask questions and provide some answers, and for board members to share their insights regarding the mine site, what they've heard today, and what is provided in the agenda package. Just a little more information on, you've heard me refer to the CERCLA process. CERCLA refers to the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act. And I want to point out that Leviathan Mine is a federally listed Superfund site, and US EPA is acting or serving as the lead agency. And as a Superfund or CERCLA site, and CERCLA refers to Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act, that is the federal law that provides a comprehensive federal state framework for responding to the release or threatened release of hazardous substances into the environment. This law and the accompanying regulations set forth detailed procedures for investigating and remediating contaminations at sites like the Leviathan Mine site. And as lead agency, US EPA is ultimately responsible for overseeing and directing the investigation and selecting the response actions and overseeing their implementation. US EPA completes this work in coordination with state agencies like the Water Board and stakeholders. The coordination with state agencies, the Water Board in this situation has been designated as the support agency for the site. So it's under this regulatory framework that we are operating for the Leviathan Mine Superfund site. And it is under CERCLA that the documents such as the focus feasibility study that we'll be talking about and the technical and practicability evaluation are developed, reviewed, and then incorporated further into the CERCLA process. Next slide, please. Today's presentation is going to include a lot of background and supporting information in order to bring us all up to date and to provide some context. So we're going to start out with some history, and then we'll discuss where we are within the CERCLA process with the early final remedial action effort. And we'll also discuss where we're in the CERCLA process with a parallel process, the site-wide effort. Both of these are going through CERCLA on parallel tracks. We'll also dive into what is the early final final remedial action, or EFRA, and then touch upon the unique situation in which the Water Board finds itself when reviewing CERCLA documents, other supporting documents regarding the mine site. I'll share some of the information with some of the challenges where we with US EPA, Atlantic Richfield, and stakeholders have been and continue to work on, and then I'll discuss some potential pathways for resolving them. I'd like to discuss what we intend to work upon in our discussions with EPA, Atlantic Richfield, and stakeholders, and then we'll wrap up with questions and answers and an opportunity for board members to share their insights. Next slide, please. Let's first get oriented on where the mine site is. You can see it highlighted in the lower right-hand corner. And it's located about 7,000 feet in eastern Alpine County. It is a remote site. It's approximately 25 miles southeast of South Lake Tahoe. It's about 5 miles from the Nevada state line to the east. We can access the site from Highway 395 to the east. And this is the route that we use to transport most of our supplies and equipment to the site. We can also access the mine site off of Highway 89 from the south of the site. Next slide, please. I want to share this watershed map. This is a map of the Bryant Creek watershed. It's outlined in the blue broad line there. And the Bryant Creek watershed includes Leviathan Creek and Aspen Creek, which are located on either side of the star depicting Leviathan Mine. And Leviathan Creek actually runs through the mine site where it was actively mined. And Aspen Creek is also in the area directly affected by mining operations. Leviathan Creek flows from in a generally northerly direction here. So that's from the bottom of the picture moving upwards. And about a mile downstream of the active where the active mining was happening, Aspen Creek comes into it. And then the creek continues to flow as Leviathan Mine Creek until it meets its confluence with Mountaineer Creek. And below the confluence of Mountaineer and Leviathan Creek, that's where Bryant Creek starts, and it flows, eventually crossing the state line and flowing into the East Carson River, East Fork Carson River, about 9 miles downstream of the mine site. Let's see. Next slide, please. So now that we know where we are, let's talk about a little history of the site. The mine site has been in and out of operation beginning in the 1860s and finally ended in the early 1960s. I recognize that this slide says the 1950s, but it actually operations continued into the early 1960s. And it started out as an underground operation, mining operation, but when Anaconda bought the facility and started operations, they turned it into an open pit mining operation. And this exposed the underlying sulfur-rich and metals-rich geology to water and oxygen. And it's this combination of elements that generates acid mine drainage, or AMD, and causes the dissolution of metals from the surrounding soils and allows those metals to flow into the underlying groundwater. Now, in order to address the AMD and other mine waste discharges that were flowing into and eroding into Leviathan Creek and Aspen Creek, the state of California purchased the mine site in 1984 and completed construction of the pollution abatement project in 1985. And it was the pollution abatement project that was intended to take on some of the more severe site conditions and sources of pollution that were severely degrading the water quality and aquatic habitat of Leviathan Creek, Aspen Creek, Bryant Creek, all the way down to the East Fork Carson River. So that was the purpose of the pollution abatement project. Next slide, please. I'm going to share this slide so that you can see some of the elements of the pollution abatement project, why I describe them and discuss some of the other history of the site. So the pollution abatement project consisted of constructing 5 lined evaporation ponds, which are viewable within this slide. They also involved constructing within the pit, which is located over on the right-hand side of the picture. They constructed the pit under drain. They did regrading in the pit, and they constructed a stormwater conveyance system within the pit. You can also note the adit or tunnel number 5 in the lower portion of the pit. And that will, I'll speak to what that is in just a moment. In fact, I'll speak to it right now. The pit under drain and the adit are 2 of the 5 primary AMD discharges at the site. And they are the most polluted AMD discharges of the 5. The other 3 primary AMD discharges at the site include the channel under drain, which is located at the upper end of the light blue line in the upper left-hand corner of this picture. The delta seep, which is located just a little further up the slide near the base of the delta slope. And the aspen seep, which is not shown on this slide, but is located just off the slide northeast of the pit. So those are the 5 source primary AMD discharges at the site. And the pollution abatement project also included construction of twin concrete culverts and concrete line channels to isolate Leviathan Creek flows from the mineways it had been flowing through. The concrete line channels are depicted by the solid light blue lines, and the twin concrete culverts are depicted by the dashed blue line. And Leviathan Creek, again, is flowing from the bottom towards the top of the picture. The pond system was designed to collect and store AMD from the adit and pit under drain in the ponds, where it could evaporate, and in doing so, would reduce AMD discharges to Leviathan Creek. However, in wetter years, the pond system would discharge to Leviathan Creek, typically during the spring when creek flows were higher. So in response to these periodic discharges, the Water Board conducted a 2-year pilot project beginning in 1999. And that was to evaluate the feasibility of seasonally treating the AMD and direct precipitation being captured and stored within the ponds, and the combination of AMD and direct precipitation we refer to as pond water, and to see if we could prevent these periodic discharges. In the meantime, in 2000, US EPA placed the mine site on the national priorities list. Thus, the mine site became a Superfund site and began operating under or being overseen under CERCLA. This resulted in the state and Atlantic Richfield, who had purchased Anaconda Mining, coming under US EPA orders for removal actions. And per these US EPA orders, the Water Board continued to be responsible for AMD from the adit and pit under drain, and Atlantic Richfield became responsible for AMD flows from the channel under drain, the delta seep, and the aspen seep. Next slide, please. Looking ahead a little further, the Water Board's pond water treatment pilot project demonstrated that seasonal pond water treatment for purposes of restoring pond capacity going into the wetter months was feasible. And in 2001, we started incorporating that as part of our regular operations out there. And we did we have been treating seasonally, typically during the summer, early fall months, to create adequate pond storage capacity going into the fall, winter, and spring months. And we've continued to do that ever since. Occasionally in wetter years, we would need to set up a temporary treatment system and conduct emergency spring treatment operations. The results of all these efforts, the Water Board has treated over 166 million gallons of pond water through the 2021 treatment system, preventing the discharge of untreated AMD from the adit and the pit under drain from entering Leviathan Creek. Another significant event occurred in 2015 when a number of state agencies and Lake Richfield signed a settlement agreement establishing roles, responsibilities, and a cost-sharing program for the Leviathan mine site. Lake Richfield is responsible for completing remedial investigation and feasibility study, or RIFS, actions, while the Water Board is responsible for design, construction, operations, and maintenance of all future remedial actions. The Water Board is also responsible for regulatory compliance of those remedial actions. Each of these involves cost sharing between Atlantic Richfield and the Water Board, even where the Water Board is responsible for the task. And to bring us up to where we are today, Atlantic Richfield proposed an early final remedial action, or the EFRA, in early 2019, consisting of year-round capture of the five primary discharges of AMD and the ability to treat them year-round for pH and select metals with the discharge to Leviathan Creek. The goal of the EFRA, to improve water quality and other environmental conditions within Leviathan Creek through year-round capture of the five primary AMD discharges. Remember, currently two of them, of the AMD discharges, the channel underdrain and delta seep, they are only captured seasonally, typically beginning in May and lasting into October with treatment. Then the remainder of the year, these two AMD discharges discharge directly into Leviathan Creek without treatment. Like Richfield, US EPA, and the Water Board, while we continue to work on the EFRA, moving it through the CERCLA process over the next couple of years, and in early August 2021, Atlantic Richfield submitted a draft focus feasibility study for the EFRA, followed by a draft technical and practicability evaluation in late September 2021. Water Board staff reviewed both documents in depth and submitted comments to US EPA on January 14th. 2022. Next slide, please. So those are some of the historical highlights that bring us to where we are today. And let's look at where that puts us within the CERCLA process itself. As shown on this diagram, the CERCLA process is a multi-step process, starting with pre-remedial actions, such as our pond water treatment system operations out there, or say Atlantic Richfield's high-density sludge treatment operations. That's followed by the Remedial Investigation Feasibility Study, or RIFS, where the major site assessment and characterization work occurs, and remedial technologies and alternatives are evaluated. Then one begins to enter the remedial selection process with initial remedial action identification, followed by development of a proposed plan by EPA that is released for public comment. The process then proceeds to selecting a remedial action and developing the record of decision that describes the remediation plan for the site cleanup. Then we're off to the races with implementation of the remedial actions, and including design, construction, operation, maintenance, and a follow-up review every 5 years. We are currently in the remedial investigation feasibility study and remedial selection process steps of the CERCLA process, and these are outlined in blue on the left-hand side. However, as with many things at Leviathan Mine, there's a little more complexity than indicated by this slide. There are actually two efforts at the Leviathan Mine site moving in parallel through the CERCLA process. There is what is referred to as the site-wide remedial investigation feasibility study that is intended to assess the nature and extent of environmental impacts related to mining activities and the resulting conditions. And in doing so, is evaluating 12 different media, such as surface water, groundwater, stream sediments, floodplain soils, mine waste, and fish tissue, to name about half of them, as part of the remedial investigation process. The early final remedial action is a final remedy, and as such, must go through the CERCLA process outlined on this slide. However, since the EFRA is more targeted in nature and not intended to address all site problems, the EFRA can actually proceed before the site-wide RIFS is completed. This process can create a challenging situation that you need to have enough information developed for the EFRA to proceed through the CERCLA process. While the primary mechanism for generating that information, the site-wide RIFS, is still underway. So the benefit of being able to do so is we can identify reasonably discrete actions that can be taken in a shorter time period and address some known discharges or contamination at the site. So we can take care of what we kind of term as low-hanging fruit. At this point, though, the Water Board staff see that some additional information and analysis from the ongoing site-wide RIFS is still needed to consider and evaluate some of the EFRA elements as currently proposed. And it's also unclear to Water Board staff how approving the EFRA as currently proposed would affect remedial action identification selection for media that could affect surface and groundwater quality, which are targeted in the EFRA, while such media and other media are still being evaluated, assessed under the site-wide RIFS step. So that's the quandary we find ourselves in. But as I'll share with you in a little bit, we have some ideas on how to we may be able to navigate our way through this. Next slide, please. Let's now take a little closer at the EFRA and its evolution. Lac Richfield first proposed the EFRA in early 2019, and the concept was very simple. Year-round capture of the five primary AMD discharges with the ability to treat year-round for pH and metals. The purpose of doing so, improve water quality and continue progress towards restoring beneficial uses within Leviathan Creek and downstream and Aspen Creek and downstream surface waters. Remember, two of the five primary AMD sources, the channel under drain, which is shown in this picture, and the Delta Seep are only seasonally captured and treated, typically May through October. Otherwise, these two discharges go into Leviathan Creek untreated. The proposal has several benefits, including the year-round capture of those of all the sources, five primary sources, and also replacing the existing three treatment systems that we use to treat these sources or discharges with a new single treatment system based on high-density sludge treatment technology. We also get a single sludge type rather than the three different types of sludges that are produced by the three different systems now. We also eliminate the need for emergency spring treatment operations because we'll be able to treat year-round with the new system. And then by capturing and treating these five discharges year-round, we'll also be able to see how much improvement we realize in creek quality, in creek habitat, beneficial use restoration, and possibly how much further we have to go. These are all positive elements of the EFRA that staff fully supports and believes are ready for prime time, and that we will be able to see the benefits of improved water quality in Leviathan and Bryant Creeks sooner than later. This is what was originally viewed as the low-hanging fruit that should be pursued, and staff agrees. One important point to note is what the EFRA does not cover. And that is, it does not include the treatment for sulfate and total dissolved solids, as lime treatment technology does not remove sulfate and increases total dissolved solids. And addressing these two constituents is actually part of the site-wide effort. Next slide, please. So after the effort was initially proposed, over the following few months, Lac Richfield subsequently introduced the concept of the EFRA also serving as the final remedial action for addressing the underlying groundwater that has been impacted by mining activities and resulting site conditions. This proposed expansion in scope also included proposed institutional controls limiting the use of the groundwater at the site and designating land use of the mine site and surrounding areas for industrial use or as industrial use. Next slide, please. So Water Board staff, we continue to work with EPA and Lac Richfield on the EFRA. And while doing so, we expressed our concern on multiple occasions that this proposed expansion in scope was unnecessarily increasing the project's complexity and time for moving the EFRA through the CERCLA process. And despite putting this forth, in June 2021, US EPA did direct Atlantic Richfield to draft the Focus Feasibility Study, or FFS, and the Technical and Practicability Evaluation, or what I'll refer to as the TIE, for the EFRA, identifying the area and resources covered by the EFRA to include both surface and groundwater within the Leviathan Creek watershed and the surface water in Bryant Creek down to the East Fork Carson River. The FFS and the TIE provide the foundational information analysis that are intended to support US EPA's proposed plan for the EFRA that will be released in the future for public comment. And it's the next and is the next significant step towards a record of decision. And these areas and resources that are identified within the FFS as being addressed by the EFRA, that's referred to as an operable unit. And in this case, the operable unit is titled as operable unit number one, and you'll hear me reference that later on. There is also the possibility of identifying future operable units where we it's deemed that additional carve-outs from the site-wide RIFS effort are deemed appropriate. So with the release of the draft FFS on August 6, 2021, it became the first comprehensive document that really described the elements of the EFRA as currently proposed and provided Atlantic Richfield's basis for identifying specific components of the recommended alternative identified in the FFS. And so now the FFS or the EFRA has evolved yet again, and we have that full picture now. And what it includes is year-round capture of the five primary AMD discharges that I've discussed before to be stored in the existing ponds prior to treatment. One of the ponds is proposed to be significantly deepened to add approximately 8.4 million gallons of additional storage. The EFRA also includes a new centralized high-density sludge treatment facility that would be located near Pond 4, where the existing HDS system is, and that would replace the existing three treatment systems. It also includes on-site sludge disposal, and I'll get into that one in a little more detail in a few minutes, and also bringing grid-based power to the site. Right now, everything is operated on generator power out there. There is no grid-based or other power source for the site, and access road improvements to allow for year-round access to the site. These are the primary physical elements of the EFRA as it is now currently proposed. Next slide, please. Other critical elements of the EFRA as proposed by Atlantic Richfield to US EPA include the EFRA would be the final remedial action for pH and select metals for all surface waters and all groundwaters in the Leviathan Creek watershed. That's part of the operable unit number one. The EFRA would also be the final remedial action for pH and select metals for all surface water within Bryant Creek down to East Fork Carson River. It's the other part of the operable unit number one. It also includes institutional controls prohibiting installation of groundwater wells at the site for domestic use. Also includes institutional controls for surface waters involving signage, advising against human activity that could result in an unacceptable exposure to contaminated surface waters. A couple more critical elements are technical and practicability waivers of what are called ARARs, and I'll get into the definition of both of those terms identified in the FFS for all groundwaters within the Leviathan Creek watershed. Think of this as basically a waiver of the standards, the regulations and stuff that apply to groundwater, waiving those. And again, I'll explain it in a couple more slides in greater detail. Also, a technical and practicability waiver of applicable standards for 6 metals in surface waters within the Leviathan Creek watershed and surface waters in Bryant Creek down to the East Fork Carson River. So the EFRA, as currently proposed, continues to have those elements that Water Board staff supported with the originally proposed EFRA, but it now has some elements that staff sees need some additional analysis and will require discussions among EPA, Atlantic Richfield, and the stakeholders. And that needs to happen before any final conclusions and decisions are made regarding these issues. What staff would like to see is movement on all fronts. That includes implementing those elements staff sees as ready to go while working to resolve those elements staff sees as not quite ready for prime time. And we will continue to engage with EPA, Atlantic Richfield, stakeholders to resolve these open issues and concerns regarding the certain aspects of the EFRA. And among other challenges, we'll be looking at the additional information analysis that's being developed under the site-wide FS and how it applies and interacts with the EFRA. And some of that additional information that we're still needing is still needed to understand the nature and extent of mining-related impacts on surface waters and groundwaters and the risk that those impacts present to human health and the environment. Next slide, please. This map's included in the presentation just to give you a visual of the areas and resources within the scope of the operable unit that is part of the EFRA. You have the surface waters and groundwaters of the Leviathan Creek watershed that more or less surround the mine site, which is near the center of the picture here. And then you also have the surface waters of Bryant Creek down to the East Fork Carson River, which are highlighted near the upper half of the picture here, provided in this slide. Next slide, please. So let's look at what is a focused feasibility study. What are the purposes of the technical and practicability evaluation? First, primary elements of a focused feasibility study. The focused feasibility study, or FFS, is the first CERCLA document that proposes remedial action objectives, or RAOs. And RAOs specify contaminants of concern, potential exposure pathways, and remediation goals. And currently, there are 2 RAOs proposed for the EFRA. The first one addresses surface waters, and it's to prevent unacceptable exposure of human and aquatic organisms to acidity or pH and AD or acid drainage metals in surface water associated with the former Leviathan mine. The second one is focused on groundwater, and it is prevent unacceptable human exposure through ingestion and dermal contact to mining impacted groundwater. So those are the currently proposed RAOs. The next FFS element is what we call applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements, or ARARs. So you've heard this term before, a slide or two before. ARARs are the standards and requirements which a proposed project must meet. Examples include applicable elements of our basin plan, such as water quality objectives, beneficial uses. Also includes regulatory requirements from, say, California Code of Regulations, Title 23 and Title 27 for siting, designing, operating waste management units. Those would be applicable to any on-site sludge disposal facilities. Also, we have State Water Board Resolution 9249 that establishes our site investigation and waste cleanup processes, in addition to establishing criteria and conditions under which a containment zone or zones may be established. Maybe a role for that in the future, the containment zones. And we also have the State Implementation Plan, which is short for a much longer title, but that establishes the process for developing effluent limitations for discharges to surface waters taking into consideration treatment system capabilities and water quality standards. The next element is a technology screening and alternatives analysis. This is where the feasibility analysis begins, with evaluating potential technologies and their abilities to address specific conditions at the mine site. Some of the technologies evaluated in the FFS include those associated with AMD storage and treatment technologies, sludge management and disposal technologies. And after these technologies are screened, the ones that pass through the screening process are packaged into alternatives. And those alternatives undergo further analysis and eventually lead to a recommended alternative. There's also a risk reduction analysis in the FFS, and that looks at alternatives and evaluates how they will reduce risk to human health and the environment. Staff has questions about the no action alternative being based upon no capture of AMD from the five primary AMD sources or discharges. And those are conditions that haven't existed since the early 1980s. We think that consideration needs to be given in the analysis that are based upon current pollution abatement activities at the mine site, and that have been there beginning from the mid-80s and some coming in around 2000 and since then. That would at least give a better analysis or more complete analysis and depiction of what kind of risk reduction we could expect from current conditions, including we could see the progression also of where we've come also from when there was no capture. And then, as stated above, the FFS drafted by Atlantic Richfield provides a recommended alternative. And this includes specifics regarding treatment facility location, treatment technology, AMD storage prior to treatment, and on-site sludge management and disposal facilities location, among other components that are included in the recommended alternative. So that is an overview of the components of the FOCUS feasibility study. Next slide, please. Black Richfield also drafted a technical and practicability evaluation, or TIE, for the EFRA. And the purpose of the TIE is to evaluate technology and its ability or inability to attain ARORs. And the TIA is also intended to provide the basis upon which EPA would grant technical and practicability waivers of specific ARORs through the record of decision. So that would be where it would be deemed based on appropriate analysis and justification that certain ARORs cannot be met. And therefore, the mechanism for addressing such situations are these technical and practicability waivers, which are based upon information analysis in the TIEs. Next slide, please. A little more background, and then we'll get into some more into details of some of our challenges. Regarding the technical and practicability waivers that Atlantic Richfield has proposed, we're looking at waivers of all ARORs that are identified in the FFS. A couple of examples, not a complete list of examples of such ARORs. They include the State Water Board's policies and procedures for cleanup and abatement of discharges. That's State Water Board Resolution 9249, which includes direction on how to clean up levels. And it also establishes the State Water Board's containment zone policy. Another example of ARORs that would be that are proposed for waiver include beneficial uses and narrative water quality objectives for groundwater. And Atlantic Richfield proposes to apply these TI waivers to all the groundwaters within the Leviathan Creek watershed. That includes groundwaters upgrading of the mine site, mine influence groundwater, and groundwater that has not been affected by mining activities associated with Leviathan Mine. For surface water, Atlantic Richfield has proposed TI waivers of applicable standards for six metals in all surface waters within Leviathan Creek watershed and waters for the entirety of Bryant Creek. The six metals include aluminum, arsenic, beryllium, manganese, mercury, and thallium. And as far as the applicable standards that are referenced, Atlantic Richfield cited a combination of maximum contaminant levels or drinking water standards, US EPA National Recommended Water Quality Criteria for Aquatic Life and Human Health, Nevada Standard for Toxic Materials, and the California Toxic Rule criteria. Next slide, please. The last thing I want to share with you before we get into some of the details regarding challenges and complexities with the EFRA is the unique situation the Water Board finds itself in regarding our roles and responsibilities at the Leviathan mine site. First of all, we are a potential responsible party under US EPA order, and we will continue to be so in the future. So we are basically a discharger, to use layperson's terminology. And we're also operating under the 2015 settlement agreement that establishes roles and responsibilities between the Water Board and Atlantic Richfield. And as I indicated earlier, we have a cost-sharing program. Atlantic Richfield is that addresses activities such as Atlantic Richfield's remedial investigation feasibility study activities, and that also cover our responsibilities for design, constructing, operating and maintaining, and regulatory compliance for remedial actions selected through the CERCLA process. So this sets us up for a situation where we have one party recommending remedial actions, while another party, although involved with providing input, is responsible for implementing those actions. And then you have EPA, who is lead agency for the CERCLA process, actually making the decisions upon which remedial actions will be put forth. So again, they all have input, including Water Board, but you have one party making recommendations, another party making decisions, and a third party implementing. So very unique. From this perspective, the Water Board is focused on recommending and developing a set of remedial actions that can be implemented in a timely and effective manner. One other role or responsibility of the Water Board is that we are representing the state's regulatory and environmental interests and holding ourselves and the state to the same standards that we would hold any other discharger to. And as a result of this unique situation, we find ourselves wearing multiple hats and fulfilling multiple responsibilities. Next slide, please. So as stated earlier, Water Board staff sees several elements of the EFRA that staff believes they're ready to go and should move closer to implementation sooner rather than later. Staff has also identified issues that still need to be resolved in some manner and in order to have a technically and legally sound set of documents upon which to base decisions in moving the EFRA forward. I'm going to touch upon now some of these issues and then discuss potential pathways forward. AWARs are the first critical element of the CERCLA process I want to touch upon here, because they establish the requirements and standards that remedial actions must satisfy. And the Water Board, in consultation with other state agencies, submitted a list of potential AWARs in June 2019 as requested, and we submitted that to EPA at their request. The draft FFS also proposes AWARs, but does not include all of the AWARs the Water Board included in its June 2019 submittal. And some of the examples of AWARs submitted to US EPA but not included in the FFS include numerical water quality objectives for surface waters within the Bryant Creek watershed, which includes Leviathan and Aspen Creeks. And some of these water quality objectives include, among other constituents, aluminum, manganese, and iron, which are all constituents targeted for removal at Leviathan. The State Water Board's policy for implementation of toxic standards for inland surface waters in closed bays and estuaries, that's the long name for the State Implementation Plan, is also an AROR that was submitted to US EPA but not included in the FFS. And this is a statewide plan approved by EPA for use in determining effluent limitations, taking a variety of factors into consideration, including water quality objectives and treatment system performance. And there's no explanation of why this is not included or incorporated into the analysis provided by the FFS. So how do we attempt to resolve this issue? Well, we need to sit down with EPA, ARCO, stakeholders, and we, but first of all, EPA, and discuss these ARRs in detail and see where we have agreement and see where and why we may have areas of disagreement. We're also going to be sitting down with the State Board and Cal EPA managers and executives to brief and consult with them as we continue to proceed through the CERCLA process. And we'll also need to have similar discussions or conversations with other state agencies, as again, the Water Board is representing the state's regulatory and environmental interests. So it's not just the Water Board's interest in this case. Next slide, please. Groundwater is another area or element of the EFRA where we see more work needs to be done. And identifying the EFRA as the final remedial action for groundwater impacted by mining activities and resulting conditions, that's introduced a significant set of technical and legal complexities. And our ongoing work to address these complexities includes identifying background conditions, the extent of groundwater impacted by mining activities. The FFS proposes using specific concentrations for two constituents to define mine-influenced groundwater for purposes of delineating the impact of groundwater. This may turn out to be a valid approach, but the validity of this approach has yet to be established. And Water Board staff and its consultant with Desert Research Institute, we've provided some specific questions about the definition and the process of delineating the mine-influenced groundwaters, but we have not seen any responses to our latest round of questions and comments. The basis for some of the conclusions and recommendations in the FFS also rely upon a groundwater conceptual site model put forth by Atlantic Richfield that is presented in a draft groundwater report prepared for Atlantic Richfield. And the conceptual site model still needs verification. And we are also working to ensure that the substantive requirements of State Water Board Resolution Number 9249 are applied to the EFRA, whether it is for establishing cleanup levels or evaluating a containment zone. Also, although it's not shown on this slide, there is also the matter that under the site-wide effort, there are other remedial actions that could affect source control for AMD, such as additional stormwater conveyance systems, revegetation, but how such potential remedial actions are taken into consideration or affected by the EFRA remains unclear. And this is another example of where it is critically important to clearly delineate the relationship between the EFRA and subsequent remedial action selection process for the entire mine site under the site-wide effort. Again, continued discussion with EPA and Atlantic Richfield while consulting with State Board, Cal EPA, and other state agencies will be our next steps. Next slide, please. Another critical element of the EFRA is on-site sludge disposal, which would be a significant departure from current operations. Currently, all sludge from the acid mine drainage treatment facilities across the site is transported to a waste management site in Beatty, Nevada. Our sludge, Atlantic Richfield sludge, is now characterized as non-RCRA hazardous waste, meaning it is a hazardous waste per California regulations, but not federal regulations. The Water Board or another state agency under the current proposal would be the owner and operator responsible for regulatory compliance for any on-site sludge management and disposal facility in perpetuity. And it is currently unknown how the sludge will be characterized in the future with a new treatment system, and there remain questions regarding additional geotechnical conditions and site stability. Protection for the pit under drain is also going to need to be evaluated, because it's just looking at this picture near where the truck is with the yellow cab, the current proposal, or actually it's between the trucks here in the center. The current proposal is to basically put a dam across the mouth there and use the pit, which is a portion of which is being shown here. That's actually our pit clarifier. But storing, pumping up the sludge slurry, allowing the solids to settle and the remaining effluent to be decanted for discharge to the Leviathan Creek. That's what is in the current FFS. So again, a significant departure. We're not sure what the how that sludge would be characterized. For purposes of the FFS, it was assumed that it would continue to be a non-RCRA hazardous waste. So we also need to look at the potential benefits of the on-site sludge disposal, being reduced hauling and reduced infiltration, as this facility, if it was to be constructed here, would be a lined facility. And that would prevent the rain, snow, and stuff from percolating down through the mine waste and the acid-generating materials to create more AMD. So those are some of the pros, cons that we need to look at. We need to look at, consult with EPA. We need to be consulting with State Board. And see if there is any, I'll say, appetite to locate a waste management unit on state property to be responsible for regulatory compliance in perpetuity. And we'll be continuing to have discussions on this matter too. Next slide, please. The recommended alternative is pretty specific in its facility siting, AMD management and storage methods, sludge management facilities, as we just touched upon, to name a few. At this time, Water Board staff finds that the information that's been presented is insufficient to justify this level of specificity that's provided in the FFS regarding some of the elements I just touched upon and some other elements. A couple of examples, one being the proposal now, the recommended action includes selecting the location of the new treatment facility, and it's proposing to locate it near the existing HDS treatment system at Pond 4. While Water Board staff has identified a number of potential advantages of siting the treatment facility near Pond 1, both sites still require additional evaluation. The Pond 4 site still needs additional geotechnical analysis, including the slope near Pond 4 that experienced a slide in 2017, interrupting the use of one of the site's primary roads to the upper ponds, and also threatening Pond 4 itself. The Pond 1 site still needs to undergo significant evaluation, and that's one of our recommendations, is that the FFS looks at that. Another example would be whether AMD should be stored in ponds prior to treatment versus directly treating AMD as it is discharged from its surfaces. The benefit of what this latter approach called direct source treatment is that it avoids the need to treat snow melt and rain that falls directly into the ponds, and this comes at a considerable cost. Direct source treatment also allows or provides typically a more stable or less variable influent quality, which is typically good for treatment systems. And that's because the AMD is not being diluted in the wetter months, and it's not being concentrated through evaporation during the drier months. However, in order to do that direct source, we would need some tank technology storage, and the tank storage for AMD has been a technology that's currently screened out because it was evaluated as a technology for replacing all existing pond storage. We're looking at a much more limited use or limited scale, and we believe that this alternative of direct source treatment is still viable and may be preferable. And so we'd like to see some of these technologies that have been screened out retained, and that we do the additional evaluation that's still necessary and required during the remedial design phase of the whole process. And to move in that direction, we'll be having additional discussions with EPA and Atlantic Richfield. Next slide, please. I also want to touch upon the effluent and surface water quality analysis in the FFS. A couple of issues. One, the FFS, as I mentioned before, did not incorporate the state implementation plan, which the Water Board has identified as an AROR. And again, the state implementation plan establishes the process for developing effluent limitations for discharges to surface waters. And there is no explanation why this process was not incorporated into the FFS. Additionally, we have several questions regarding the surface water quality analysis in the FFS and how it characterizes future water quality in the creeks. And then we also returns us to the issue of if and how the EFRA could affect the remedial action selection process for surface water, groundwater, and other media that are still being evaluated and analyzed through the site-wide RIFS. And the beaver complex shown in this picture is an example of this situation, as it presents problems related to what is covered by the EFRA versus the site-wide EFRA effort and decisions involving surface water and groundwater quality. Next slide, please. Spend a little time with the technical and practicability evaluation, or the TIE. As stated in our comments to US EPA, Water Board staff is open to the possibility that limited and discrete TI waivers may be needed for the Leviathan mine site. However, before finalizing any waiver, an appropriate and phased approach for doing so needs to be followed, including proper site characterization and also maybe involving implementing one or more additional source control measures in order to develop the appropriately limited TI waivers. As stated earlier, there are still a number of outstanding questions and data gaps regarding groundwater characterization and the extent of groundwater contamination, and they need to be addressed before we can make any final decisions on TI waivers. Situation is similar for surface waters, as there are still questions regarding the new HDS treatment system's performance, including for the metals that Atlantic Richfield has proposed TI waivers for. It's important to note that while some data from Atlantic Richfield's 2020 high-density sludge treatability study were used in the FFS effluent analysis and calculations, the report for that study was not released until January 28th of this year, four or five months after we received the draft FFS. And there are also questions regarding if additional effluent polishing treatment, such as reverse osmosis or ion exchange on a limited basis, could be a viable option for further improving effluent quality or metals reduction, and that could be evaluated during remedial design. So when we've reviewed the report, the HDS treatability study, we are We're currently reviewing it and we're preparing comments. The good news is our preliminary review of the report indicates that the HDS system of the combined AMD flows does show some encouraging results for metals removal by means of HDS treatment followed by filtration. So still a lot of information to take into consideration and evaluate and then to discuss in how it would affect any decisions to develop limited discrete TI waivers in the future. So something else to work on. Next slide, please. So I understand these are some complex issues I've just outlined, and I recognize that they need to be addressed in a manner that the state can support. So do we just put the brakes on while we work through these issues, or do we have some potential pathways forward that allow us to move the process forward while working on these issues? Staff strongly believes that there may be some potential pathways that allow us to continue moving forward, seeking the direct improvements to water quality that we've identified with the EFRA while we continue to work out these issues that I've just outlined. And we plan to discuss with EPA and Atlanta Richfield conducting the necessary additional analysis that is needed to make some of the system design operational decisions during remedial design, which follows the record of decision, but would be built into the record of decision. And we are hopeful that the results of these discussions could provide a viable pathway forward towards improved water quality at and down gradient of Leviathan Mine. Also for groundwater, again, we need to collect the data necessary, conduct the analysis that are necessary to determine the adequacy of the conceptual site model and to properly characterize groundwater impacts. And that's what provides a significant portion of the foundation or should of the TIA weight analysis. And when this analysis is complete, then the water board will be in a much better position to evaluate whether a limited TI waiver may be appropriate. Next slide, please. We should be on slide 26. There we go. For surface waters, we need to assess the new HDS treatment system's performance under a range of conditions that the system will encounter. You just heard that we got a treatability study report. Couple months ago, or a month or so, month and a half ago. We're still evaluating that. We're going to have to see how this system performs. And this includes further evaluation during remedial design, also of whether other treatment technologies could provide additional effluent polishing on a limited basis to further reduce metals concentration. Again, then after we've conducted this type of evaluation, the board would be in a much better position to evaluate whether a TI waiver may be appropriate. Next slide, please. So ultimately, what are the next steps? As you have heard me say, we sit down with US EPA, Atlanta Richfield, State Board, Cal EPA, other state agencies, stakeholders, and we start working on what you've heard today. We are still relatively early in the CERCLA process, and the draft FFS and TIE, they are the first time that we've seen the EFRA in its entirety and Atlantic Richfield's analysis behind the EFRA. This includes discussions of ARARs, remedial action objectives, characterization of groundwater impacts, and consideration of source control measures that may be evaluated under the site-wide effort, and the possible consideration of one or more TI waivers. So now it's all been packaged up and produced in a comprehensive report, and we can now start to see and evaluate how things work together, what was still needed. And so in order to do that, next slide, please. We're going to continue to work with you with State Board, Cal EPA, other state agencies, EPA, Atlantic Richfield, regarding on-site sludge disposal and off-site sludge disposal options. As we conduct the necessary geotechnical and other site investigation activities are conducted to see if on-site sludge disposal is actually a viable option from a technical, regulatory, and policy perspective. We are also going to work towards keeping options open regarding some of the technologies that are currently screened out. And we look at a couple of other alternatives during remedial design before selecting specific system components. We develop the appropriate information and conduct the necessary analysis so we can make well-informed decisions. We will also work on incorporating this state implementation plan into the effluent and surface water analysis. And we will work on ensuring that supporting the EFRA does not inadvertently preclude future remedial actions regarding other media currently being evaluated under the site-wide effort. Next slide, please. We are also going to work on ensuring that appropriate information analysis forms the basis for any limited and discrete TI waivers in the future. And we will work on ensuring that State Water Board Resolution Number 9249 continues to play an appropriate role in the development of any TI waiver. And finally, we will work on developing pathways forward that allow us to achieve the benefits of the EFRA sooner rather than later, and also allow us to address the issues we have discussed today so that we have the technically and legally sound documents to inform the public and upon which to base decisions that will have lasting effects at the site and downstream of the site. Next slide, please. That completes staff's presentation. And I want to thank you for your time. It has been some time here and your attention. Do you have any questions?
Well, that's a substantial amount of information.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is. Before we go to asking the board, I don't have any indication that there's anyone from the public who wishes to speak on this matter. I just want to verify if that my understanding is correct, or if there's someone out there that didn't submit a card or that submitted a card that I didn't see but does want to speak. I'd like to know that.
Chair Pumphrey, we do not have anybody who would like to speak on this item.
Thank you. Let's then turn to questions, discussion, comments by board members. Mr. Diaz.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Scott, I've got a question. I think it was on slide 27. Can you call it up? Yes. Under the bullet of ARARs, you're recommending that we incorporate currently excluded ARARs. Who had made the decision to exclude the ARARs prior?
What I'm referring to as excluded ARARs is basically the difference between the list that we submitted to US EPA in 2019 and the different list that Atlantic Richfield put forth in the focus feasibility study and in the TIE or the technical and practicability evaluation. There's a significant number of ARARs we identified that were not included in the draft FFS and the draft TIE. And ultimately, it's EPA's call on what to include, what to not include. But that's where, close that gap. That's what we're looking for.
So your recommendation is in turn to recommend to EPA that the excluded ARARs are incorporated. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Have you had discussions with Atlantic Richfield about that?
There were some brief discussions between EPA and Atlantic Richfield and the Water Board very early on, I'd say, shortly after, but nothing really focused. And again, with the there hadn't been much talk leading up to the FFS or following our submittal of the potential ARARS list in June 2019. There was not much discussion. And so this is really the first time we've seen a new list. And now it's time for the discussions to start.
Do we anticipate resistance from Atlantic Richfield in incorporating the excluded ARARS?
I think there might, based on just what they've presented and what we've presented, I think there'll be some challenging ones probably.
Okay. Thank you. Good answers. I have no more questions. Very good presentation and very thorough.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Horn.
I'm unmuted. Okay. Well, my head is spinning. So forgive me if I miss anything. Just a blanket statement is I support all of the staff recommendations that applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements that the Water Board proposed investigating should be included in the studies. It seems premature to have a final solution about groundwater in general, because much of the information needed to make that decision doesn't exist yet. More studies are needed. State Resolution 9249 should absolutely be maintained in applicability. I'm going to skip over some, but I support them all. On-site sludge disposal for me at this point seems like not a very good idea. It adds responsibility to and risk to the state of California, and responsibilities and risks to Lahontan staff. Maybe there's a way to work that out. I don't know, but at this point, I'm not inclined to like that idea. Do not screen out technologies and alternatives that the Water Board identified in an FFS comments. I agree with that. The expansion of the EFRA seemed, many of the ideas in there seemed premature to me, and kind of a surprise to the staff, which is worrisome. The investigations and analysis on the waivers is needed. Again, maintain the applicability of State Resolution 9249. On and on. Let me see if there's anything else I want to say. The no action alternative should be based on existing conditions and not go back to prior, before any of the treatment systems were put in place. Doing that is not a fair representation of the improvements by these by the final solution. I support numerical water quality objectives for Leviathan Creek. Let's see what else I have here. I do support going forward on the parts of the EFRA on which the Lahontan staff and Atlantic Richfield agree. I think that's those are my comments.
Thank you.
Board Member Mustafavi.
Thank you, Scott, for that. That gave me a lot of context. AGP, if you could pull up slide 12, please. So in the spirit of climate change, resilience, preparedness, risk reduction, I would, and this is specific to the second to last point with regard to permanent grid-based power supply. I'd recommend that staff look into micro hydro or renewable energy sources generated at point of use to offset risks of having grid-based power supply in light of the forested areas that surround the area. I can appreciate having generators cause air quality concerns as well as fire risk, but I just thought that this might be something that staff can look into. Thank you.
I'm in agreement with the comments that were made by other board members, and I don't propose to repeat those. I hope that in terms of how long it takes this process to play out, that we're as early in the process, in a long process, as it appears that we need to be, given the number of things that you've brought to light that we just don't know an awful lot about. And I'm concerned with the idea that a quote unquote final solution has to be based on every possible piece of information that we can look for and obtain. I'm concerned about the technical impracticality waivers. I'm worried that that doesn't allow for the development even if, after we come to the end of this process, of technology that might make it possible to obtain some of these standards, or if it either means that we're frozen in time and those objectives are permanently waived in perpetuity, or it means that we bear all the responsibility for implementing any future technology that might become viable. So, you know, we end up on the hook of a lot of potential issues, both foreseeable and all of the unforeseen ones into the future. And I think we have to be really careful that we fully understand the basis on which we do that. My other comment is that I just find that we are in a very uncomfortable, at a minimum, untenable, maybe beyond that situation. When you say we are the discharger, and I say to you, we are the regulators of the dischargers, right away in my mind, that just creates a problem. It certainly creates a cosmetic problem because it doesn't look exactly correct. I don't know what kind of legal problems it creates or can create, but I cannot rule out that possibility. And so, although it might not be part of this process, I think that we need to give some thought to whether or not we want to be in that position forever, or whether or not there are ways to explore either inside this process, probably not, or on a broader level, a way to resolve that situation. I don't know, this is a question, you know, are there any other water boards that are in this same kind of situation with respect to a site within their region?
Not that I'm aware of.
I wouldn't think so.
No.
And I don't know if there are any other state agencies with different jurisdictions that are in a similar position. I'd be surprised simply because it's such a crummy position to end up finding yourself in. But certainly if there are, I would hope that we could learn some lessons from that. If there are not, I think that is a guidepost to tell us and the state
you know, maybe we want to find a way to a permanent solution to this situation. I think it's an extremely poor position to be put in. It's an extremely poor position to be put in forever. That's the extent of my comments. So thank you again. That was a wonderful, although troubling, I have a headache kind of presentation. You have reminded me of all of the other times I sat in these meetings and said, thank God I don't have that guy's job. Because this is certainly one of those for me. And so I appreciate your work and your presentation. Dr. Horn, do you have something else?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I wanted to say I'm glad I like the idea of finding some way to get us out from the responsibility of being the discharger as well as the regulator. I don't know if that's possible at this point, but you raise a very good point there. And it would make things easier going forward if we could find some way to separate ourselves from that. Another comment I wanted to make was that in many of these mining sites that we end up dealing with after they've closed, we see the situation where the financial resources put up by the discharger are insufficient to cover the costs in perpetuity. And I hope that we can have sufficient protections so that we do not get in that situation with this site as well. That's all.
I would just add to the Dr. Horn's point on the financial aspect of it. That will be another thing that we are talking to State Board, Cal EPA, Department of Finance, as we move forward and get closer to implementation, design, construction, implementation. Setting up the system and setting up the financing, because the 2015 settlement agreement does establish that cost sharing, and it does put the majority of the cost on Atlantic Richfield, but we are still looking at tens of millions. Just for this, we're looking at the recommended alternative, just direct and indirect capital costs come in at around $60 million. And that's for the EFRA. We still have that site-wide effort going on. That's going to bring in additional cost. So I see Tom Bloomfield, who's a part of our legal team. He has his hand up. Tom, you have a couple comments?
Thank you. And thanks again, Scott, for an excellent presentation. My name's Tom Bloomfield. I've been working on this project for many years with David Koop and the excellent staff at the Lahontan Board. Just two quick comments. On the technical and practicability waiver, I did want to point out that under the Superfund program, once the remedy is selected, it is reviewed every 5 years. And so if new technologies come along, they would be evaluated. And if it's possible to reduce the waiver, either in geographic scope or the nature of the waiver with respect to the chemical constituents, that is part of the Superfund process. So it's not once we have a waiver in place, we're stuck with it forever. And I also wanted to point out with respect to this concern about a potential, you know, wearing these multiple hats. Certainly it's not how the Water Board usually operates. But, you know, the United States is often finds itself in this same position, right? Because it is a liable party at many sites and EPA is the regulator. And the other thing I would point out is here EPA is the ultimate decision maker on the remedy. We're very careful in how we evaluate these issues and asserting the need for meeting the state ARARs, for example. But ultimately, it's EPA's decision on selecting the remedy.
Thank you. Thank you for that information. It's helpful to me.
No.
Anything further from anyone on the board? If not, again, thank you, Scott, for all the components of that went into this presentation and the ongoing work. And I would say, and I'm sure, I'm very confident I speak for the board in this, all of the presentations in the last 2 days by the staff members were just excellent. They were information packed. They were concise, even though they were full of information. They were very well organized. They were really, really helpful to me, and I think to all of us in doing what we need to do here. So kudos to you all for your work on this meeting. I believe that does conclude the meeting. And so we're going to adjourn at this point, and we will see, hopefully, one another in May. So thank you. Thank you for your participation. Thank you for all your hard work.
Thanks, Chair Pumphrey. Good job to the team.